Epiphenomenalism is the view that phenomenal properties, the what it's like of conscious states, have no physical effects. First come the neural events, then come the experiential events, but the experiential events have no effect on the physical events. That's why it's called epiphenomenalism. Phenomenality comes after the electrochemical activity of the brain. Behavior is caused by muscles that contract upon receiving neural impulses, and neural impulses are generated by input from other neurons or from sense organs. But mental events play no causal role in the process. Thomas Huxley famously illustrated the view by likening the relationship between mind and brain to the relationship between a steam whistle and a locomotive engine. The whistle only accompanies the work of the engine, just as the steam whistle is caused by the engine's operations, but has no causal influence upon it. So the mental is caused by neural goings-on, but has no causal influence upon them. Epiphenomenalism is a form of property dualism, and it happens to avoid a few of the problems with property dualism that accept some form of mental causation. So what's wrong with epiphenomenalism? It may be counterintuitive to claim that my experience doesn't cause my behavior in any way, but that alone isn't a good reason for rejecting the view. It may seem like the pleasure of sex is what's motivating animals to have sex and reproduce, but intuitions are often wrong. On the epiphenomenalist view, the what it's like of experience comes after. It has no physical effects, and therefore is not the cause of your behavior. If this is true, you've never done anything because it feels good, or avoided pain because it would hurt. I think we can all agree that this intuitively seems wrong. It really feels like my hunger is the reason I'm making food. I take an ibuprofen because of the pain of my headache. My limbs are moving around right now, putting my body parts in different places because of my positively or negatively valenced experiences. Epiphenomenalists reject this intuition. It's no better than our intuition that the sun is going around the earth. Our consciousness talk and our inclusion of experience in the causal chain is an artifact of our language on this view. The word headache functions as a way of talking about those neuronal processes which cause the ache as well as the movement of my limbs to the medicine cabinet. Everyone agrees that the language of experience is a useful way of talking about the world, but epiphenomenalists say that it's nothing more than a useful way of talking about the world. It doesn't describe what's really happening any more than sunrise and sunset describe what's really happening. Experience never enters the causal chain, it's just produced as a useless byproduct. There are a few problems with viewing conscious experience as a mere shadow cast by physical processes. There are two evolutionary arguments against epiphenomenalism, one originating with Karl Popper and the other from William James. And James's argument is the main reason I can't accept the view myself. There are also quite a few cases wherein the causal influence of the mental is the most natural explanation. For example, the placebo effect. One very short argument against epiphenomenalism is that we're talking about consciousness right now. How is it that one can reflect upon phenomenal consciousness if it can't cause brain processes? Thinking about is a brain process, but phenomenal events aren't supposed to be able to cause brain events. The fact that we're discussing experience is evidence that it can play a role in the causal chain. Our ability to think about phenomenal consciousness is in conflict with the idea that phenomenal consciousness can't enter the causal chain. On the epiphenomenalist view, this would be like the steam whistle contributing to the work of the engine. Phenomenal states cannot cause physical events, yet here we are thinking about them, even though thinking is a matter of physical brain processes. So we could form things like this. 1. If epiphenomenalism were true, we would not be able to reflect upon phenomenality, as it cannot cause brain states. 2. We can reflect upon phenomenality. Therefore, epiphenomenalism is false. All I need for this argument to work is an admission that thinking, reflecting, speaking, and so on involve brain events. To accept that the mental can have a causal influence on the physical is to reject epiphenomenalism by definition. Claiming that phenomenal states are causing your brain or body to behave is no different than claiming your pain or pleasure is motivating your behavior. on the epiphenomenalist view, both should be impossible. An epiphenomenalist must hold that mental states are causally inert, and therefore shouldn't cause utterances about consciousness. If I say, "I love the taste of this coffee I'm drinking," we naturally suppose that my experience of the taste explains my comment about the experience of the taste. But an epiphenomenalist would be forced to say that my experience of the coffee's taste has nothing to do with my utterance, "I love the taste of this coffee I'm drinking." Again, all I need for this argument to work is an admission that utterances involve brain events. We should note that it's not easy to make sense of mental causation on physicalism or dualism, which I suspect is a big reason that arguments against epiphenomenalism never seem to land. Here's a quote from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy that illustrates my point. Quote, "To suppose that non-physical minds can move bodies is like supposing that imaginary locomotives can pull real boxcars." End quote. So this is a terrible analogy. For one, consciousness is imaginary in this analogy, but it continues. Quote, "Put differently, every voluntary action is akin to the paranormal power of telekinesis." End quote. So if your beliefs, desires, or experiences have any influence on your behavior, for example, eating food because you're hungry, having sex because it feels good, not wanting to step on a nail because it would hurt, that is akin to, quote, "imaginary locomotives pulling real boxcars," and to the paranormal power of telekinesis. Now, if you're a dualist, the telekinesis point is actually spot on. There really is no difference between moving your arm because of a ghost in the machine, or moving a pen on my desk using the ghost in the machine. Both are examples of my mind reaching out into the physical world and moving around physical matter. If you're a monist, however, it makes absolutely no sense. You can have mental causation without running into problems like that. Some people are so entrenched in dualist concepts that they seem to be unable to imagine non-dualist positions, like dual-aspect monism, in which we can have mental causation without all the problems that come with interactionism, because there is no interaction between mind and matter. On dualism and physicalism, however, it's hard to make sense of non-epiphenomenalist views. But it's also hard to make sense of epiphenomenalism. It's almost as if many of the conventional understandings of the relation of mind and matter are totally untenable once you scratch the surface. It's almost like that. Here's the basic structure of the argument against epiphenomenalism I've been taking so far. 1. If mental states have a causal effect on physical states, epiphenomenalism is false. 2. Mental states have a causal effect on physical states. Therefore, epiphenomenalism is false. So are there any plausible examples of mental states having a causal effect on brain states beyond the fact that we're discussing and reflecting upon consciousness? In fact, there is a well-documented, empirically supported, famous example of mental phenomena causally influencing neural phenomena, the placebo effect. The placebo effect and other examples of psychosomatic effects suggest that mental phenomena constrain neural phenomena, at least in some cases. We would only need one such case to refute epiphenomenalism. The philosopher Patrick Speight made this argument from psychosomatic effects in his paper, A Pill Against Epiphenomenalism. So let's run through a couple examples of the placebo effect. In a randomized placebo study conducted by J.B. Mosley and his team, 180 patients with osteoarthritis of the knee were divided into three groups. The first two groups actually underwent minimally invasive surgery, but the third group did not. The surgery was only simulated for the third group, and measures were taken to thoroughly deceive them. Placebo medications were administered, operation noises were simulated, and the staff behaved as if there was a real surgery taking place. Mosley's results: the outcomes of the operated on patients were no better than those who received the placebo surgery. The placebo effect creates quite a puzzle for epiphenomenalists. What else would have caused the disappearance of the pain but mental states? That's the most straightforward interpretation. Might not be the only coherent interpretation, but it's clearly the most natural and straightforward way to interpret the placebo effect. One might object that perceived pain is not the best example. We want to see brain states change as a result of mental states. So take another example. T.D. Wager published the following in 2004. Quote, in two fMRI experiments, we found that placebo analgesia was related to decreased brain activity in pain-sensitive brain regions, including thalamus, insula, and anterior cingulate cortex. End quote. So patients were given a placebo, and brain activity decreased in regions associated with pain. That seems to be a pretty straightforward example of the mental causing a change in brain activity. The placebo effect clearly suggests that in some cases, mental phenomena constrain neural phenomena. Popper's evolutionary argument. Consciousness is probably not cheap in terms of energy spent. Wouldn't natural selection have remedied this inefficiency rather than produce it over and over again in the animal kingdom? Why would our bodies spend precious limited resources on something that's useless? Come to think of it, how did consciousness evolve to begin with? It has no causal influence on epiphenomenalism, so it serves no function. It's useless. Why would it evolve in the first place, especially if it's energetically expensive? And keep in mind, it didn't just evolve once. It evolved throughout the animal kingdom. In 1977, Karl Popper argued that, quote, the theory of natural selection constitutes a strong argument against Huxley's theory of one-sided action of body on mind. If Huxley had been right, mind would be useless, but then it could not have evolved, no doubt over long periods of time, by natural selection. End quote. So we can restate Popper's argument as 1. Phenomenal properties evolved. 2. On epiphenomenalism, phenomenal properties are useless. 3. Useless features do not evolve. Therefore, epiphenomenalism is false. Of course, useless features do evolve. So this particular evolutionary argument isn't a knockdown argument. It's not as if every single thing that exists was adaptive and directly selected for. As long as the byproduct, or spandrel, is neutral, or neutral enough, it either won't be selected against, or the selective pressure will be negligible. A few episodes back, we discussed Beleyev's foxes and the evolution of dogs. Some genes are pleiotropic. Sometimes one gene influences two or more phenotypic traits. These traits can appear to be entirely unrelated. The point being, not everything we witness was selected for on the basis of its adaptive value. Byproducts exist, and some of them are useless. So as implausible as it seems, the what it's like of experience could have evolved as an inert byproduct of adaptive physical traits. I still find this hard to believe, since it evolved in so many unique systems and is presumably expensive. But Popper's argument isn't the only evolutionary argument against epiphenomenalism. There's a much better evolutionary argument, first articulated by William James. Quote, there is a set of facts which seem explicable on the supposition that consciousness has causal efficacy. It is a well-known fact that pleasures are generally associated with beneficial, pains with detrimental, experiences. All the fundamental vital processes illustrate this law. Starvation, suffocation, privation of food, drink and sleep, work when exhausted, burns, wounds, inflammation, the effects of poison, are as disagreeable as filling the hungry stomach, enjoying rest and sleep after fatigue, exercise after rest, and a sound skin and unbroken bones at all times, are pleasant. Mr. Spencer and others have suggested that these coincidences are due not to any pre-established harmony, but to the mere action of natural selection, which would certainly kill off in the long run any breed of creatures to whom the fundamentally noxious experience seemed enjoyable. An animal that should take pleasure in a feeling of suffocation would, if that pleasure were efficacious enough to make him immerse his head in water, enjoy a longevity of 4 or 5 minutes. But if pleasures and pains have no efficacy, one does not see why the most noxious acts, such as burning, might not give thrills of delight, and the most necessary ones, such as breathing, cause agony. End quote. So there James is making an inference to the best explanation. These correlations, on the epiphenomenalist view, are an inexplicable coincidence. James wants us to consider the fact that adaptive behavior is correlated with pleasure, and maladaptive behavior is correlated with pain. Starving, burning, and so on are correlated with unpleasant phenomenal experiences, while eating, rest, and sex are correlated with pleasure. But on epiphenomenalism, it just as easily could have been the other way around. On non-epiphenomenalist views, it's no mystery. These correlations are to be expected. So our confidence in epiphenomenalism should be greatly reduced. Remember, phenomenal experiences have no physical effects. They could not possibly cause differences in genetic fitness. Natural selection would have no way of favoring the correlations we witness over any other set of correlations. All possible sets of correlations are equally likely on epiphenomenalism. And keep in mind, it's not as if there are one or two adaptive behaviors that are correlated with positive hedonic states and a couple maladaptive behaviors that are correlated with negative hedonic states. Our experiences are systematically correlated with adaptive and maladaptive behaviors. Given natural selection, this makes perfect sense, but only if we allow for our experiences to play a causal role. In other words, if we reject epiphenomenalism. Natural selection uses our experiences to motivate our behavior. Behavior that aids in survival and reproduction is incentivized with positive hedonic states. Maladaptive behavior is disincentivized with mental states with negative hedonic value. The pleasure of sex motivates animals to have sex. The fear of being eaten motivates you to avoid being eaten. That seems obviously true. And it's supported by the correlations we observe, which are to be expected on non-epiphenomenalist views, but are the product of pure chance on epiphenomenalism. I find it impossible to believe that the systematic correlations are the product of pure chance. So why doesn't everyone see this? I suspect the answer is that it's not so easy to make sense of mental causation on physicalism. I think epiphenomenalism is motivated by a few abiding beliefs. A very general physicalist commitment, a commitment to the reality of consciousness, and the additional belief that the physical and the mental are irreducibly distinct. I think these three beliefs tend to lead people to property dualism. Epiphenomenalism comes about when the dualist realizes that accepting mental causation would lead to certain problems, such as downward causation, wherein a higher level system causally influences a lower level system, as well as overdetermination and a violation of physical causal closure. And just to explain those really quick, for every physical effect, there's a sufficient physical cause, but that leaves no room for mental causes. There's nothing left for them to do. If you nevertheless assert that there is mental causation, then you've violated causal closure and claimed that there are sometimes redundant mental causes. In other words, overdetermination. You have too many causes for one event. And we could live with overdetermination in one or two cases, but on forms of dualism that accept mental causation, we have systematic overdetermination. Physical events are systematically overdetermined. And that strikes many people as deeply implausible. So what are we to do if we share those three commitments? Physicalism is generally speaking on the right track, consciousness is real, and the subjective and objective are irreducibly distinct, that lead us to property dualism, yet can't remain property dualists. Contrary to what illuminativists want us to believe, consciousness is real and can't be reduced to the physical. Contrary to what idealists want us to believe, the physical is real and can't be reduced to the mental. Additionally, mental events are not logically entailed by brain events. But there's a way to make sense of all this. Though the subjective and objective are irreducibly distinct, we're not forced into dualism, as they are not contradictory. They can coexist in one substance, or one process. We can say that the physical has some subjective component, that the dispositions and behavior of the material realm are grounded in consciousness, that their intrinsic nature is consciousness. One is the view from the outside, so to speak, and the other is the view from the inside, what it is to be that process. This allows us to be realists about the physical, realists about the phenomenal, and accept the distinction between the two without becoming dualists. And we get to keep mental causation without any interaction. That's the beauty of dual aspect monism. Mental causation is just physical causation from another point of view. The mental doesn't cause the physical, yet we still have mental causation. There's only one process going on, but there are two aspects to this process. What it's like to be that process, and the observation of that process from the outside. Two sides of the same coin. There's what it's like to be electrochemical goings on in the brain, and there's a different way that same process looks from a third-person perspective. The only problem is that the best form of dual aspect monism is panpsychism, and people generally don't like panpsychism. There's one clarification I want to make about mental causation, or phenomenal powers, which is my preferred phrase. Free will is not what I mean by mental causation. I'm a free will skeptic. I don't believe in libertarian free will, and yet I believe in phenomenal powers. I think experiences necessitate their effects, so there's no room for libertarian freedom. The phenomenal powers view, as described by philosopher Hedda Hassel-Merck, is the view that, quote, phenomenal properties produce and thereby metaphysically necessitate their effects in virtue of how they feel, or in virtue of their intrinsic phenomenal character alone. End quote. In her paper, The Evolutionary Argument for Phenomenal Powers, she defends the phenomenal powers view as a better explanation of the correlations we've been talking about than any other view on offer. And that's not all she talks about, and I've linked the paper in the show notes. Its relevance extends far beyond what we're discussing today, and it's a fascinating read for anyone even remotely interested in philosophy of mind. So I want to come back to the abductive evolutionary argument for a moment. Here's Merck summarizing the argument. Why is pain, correlated with stimuli detrimental to survival and reproduction, such as suffocation, hunger, and burning? And why is pleasure, correlated with stimuli beneficial to survival and reproduction, such as eating and breathing? According to the argument, the fact that we have these particular correlations, and not other ones, must have an evolutionary explanation. But given epiphenomenalism, differences in phenomenal properties could not cause differences in fitness, so natural selection would not be expected to favor these correlations over any other ones. Epiphenomenalism thus renders these correlations an inexplicable coincidence. End quote. As I said, this evolutionary argument is an abductive argument. An inference to the best explanation. What needs explaining is the fact that pain is correlated with stimuli detrimental to survival and reproduction, and that pleasure is correlated with stimuli beneficial to survival and reproduction. Random chance is not a good explanation for these systematic correlations, and yet that's what epiphenomenalism is offering us. And the epiphenomenalist view is compatible with the correlations, but there's no reason to expect them. In fact, it is equally likely that maladaptive behavior would be systematically correlated with conscious states that have positive hedonic value. That state of affairs wouldn't be selected against on an epiphenomenalist view. Experiences don't have causal power, they don't enter the causal chain, and thus natural selection is unable to have an effect on the correlations. The correlations could have been inverted, with starvation feeling like sex, and sex feeling like starvation. We'd still be helplessly mating and eating because our phenomenal experiences and their hedonic valence has no influence whatsoever on our behavior. That state of affairs is equally likely as the one we actually find ourselves in on epiphenomenalism. Additionally, we could imagine the correlations being different, but not inverted. Just a random assortment of experiences correlated with behavior. Eating could feel neutral, and rest after fatigue could feel excruciating. Again, these outcomes are just as probable as the ones we observe in our world if we take epiphenomenalism to be true. I'm sure someone will be tempted to appeal to the multiverse, since the existence of a multiverse would allow for fleetingly improbable things. We've already admitted the correlations are compatible with epiphenomenalism, so why couldn't the correlations be a product of pure chance? As Merck writes, quote, "The problem of correlations could be regarded as a problem of hedonic fine-tuning. Why are the psychophysical laws such as to allow for the correlations to evolve?" I don't think there is a fine-tuning problem for life, but there certainly is a hedonic fine-tuning problem. It can easily be answered by natural selection, if we allow for phenomenal powers, but if you're irrationally committed to rejecting mental causation, then you have a real fine-tuning problem on your hands. Some think the multiverse and anthropic reasoning can get us out of the so-called fine-tuning problem for life. If the multiverse and the fine-tuning problem are real, then they'd be correct about that. But the same can't be true for the hedonic fine-tuning problem. The anthropic principle roughly states that we'll only ever find ourselves in a universe in which we can find ourselves. We wouldn't evolve in a universe that wasn't fine-tuned for life, so we'll only ever look around and see a universe before us that's been tuned for our appearance. But this anthropic reasoning doesn't apply in the case of hedonic fine-tuning. We could look around and find ourselves in a universe that's been hedonically tuned quite differently. In fact, we're more likely to find ourselves in one of those far more numerous universes where the correlations don't systematically line up with adaptivity. As Merck writes, in any universe where the correlations are different, there would still necessarily be living, phenomenally conscious creatures around to experience them. Hence, the only candidate for a non-theistic explanation of the correlations seems to be some form of non-epiphenomenalism. End quote. I frequently draw a distinction between strong and weak emergence. Weak emergence is uncontroversial. Biology is reducible to chemistry. Fluidity emerges from collections of non-fluid molecules, and so on. There's a smooth gradient of gradual change in cases of weak emergence. I've pointed out before that the emergence of consciousness couldn't have been an instance of weak emergence, as is commonly supposed, since there are no degrees of consciousness in the Nagelian what it's like sense. Any dim presence of experience is an actual instance of experience. There is no halfway point between it being like something and it not being like anything. There can't kind of be experience, or seem to be experience. If you want to say consciousness emerged weakly, you have to explain to me how Nagelian consciousness can come in degrees. I'll wait. So if we say experience emerged, it must have been an instance of strong emergence. The alternative conception of emergence is not conceivable in this case. And if it did emerge weakly, we would fall into the trap of downward causation, wherein a higher level system causally influences a lower level system. How can a whole act causally on its parts? What is a whole anyway, other than the sum of its parts? The parts are supposed to be able to influence the whole, but that interaction only goes one way. This common view of emergence would imply that consciousness is epiphenomenal. Perhaps there's some wiggle room if we take the strong emergence option, but if we suppose that consciousness is a weak emergent phenomenon, we seem to be stuck with epiphenomenalism. Avoiding downward causation, I believe, is one of the main drivers of epiphenomenalism. So if you want to say that consciousness emerged, as most do, in the same way that biology emerged from chemistry, then you'll be forced into epiphenomenalism, or you'll have to find a way to address the downward causation issue head-on. If you want to say consciousness emerged, you're going to have to commit to strong emergence. My point is this. Rejecting epiphenomenalism doesn't just mean accepting mental causation. It additionally means rejecting the prevailing notion of the emergence of experience. If we have good reason to reject epiphenomenalism, as I believe we do, then we have good reason to reject the idea that consciousness emerged in the same way biology emerged from chemistry and fluidity emerged from collections of molecules. In light of the abductive evolutionary argument, as well as the numerous plausible cases of mental causation, from psychosomatic effects to being motivated by experience, epiphenomenalism should be relegated to the same dustbin as all other forms of dualism. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.